This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. I am back to telling my car, time to be a hero today, car. Got it home last night, backed into the garage, realized I was crooked, pulled it out a little bit, needed to check on something, turned it off, went to check, came back in, car would not start. Let it set for a little while, went out, fiddled around with it a little bit, wiggled the cables, car started. I know what you're thinking, it's the post on the battery, that's what you're thinking. I don't think it is. But I am going to buy a post cleaning tool and do that tomorrow, but I just don't think that's it. I'm thinking it's the wire that goes between my battery and the starter. That's really what I'm thinking it is, but my mechanic doesn't like to fix things until it's dead flat dead. So he's like, well, wait till it really breaks and then we'll fix it. I was like, I don't want to do that. Why can't we just replace that line? But he's like, no, we'll start that. It'll just, you'll never get the end of it, and blah, 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 and, you know, so. So, I'm heading into winter. Of course, the last time this did this was like 4 months ago. And then the time before that was like 2 or 3 months ago. But, you know, winter. So, I'm trying to figure out what the magic formula is. You know, what do I have to wiggle? How do I wiggle it to get it get it to do what it's supposed to do, because I bought an extra battery to haul along with me, but I thought yesterday when it didn't start, I thought, well, fine, this is my chance to see if this works, so I got the battery out, put the thing, nothing, would not happen, so I'm really thinking it has something more to do with the wiggling of the wire than the extra power of the battery, but I hadn't charged in the battery in a real long time. I've just been hauling it around with me, so I went ahead and charged the battery last night, just in case it was that too. You know what we're doing. We're just floundering around. Anyways, good week at work this week. Got some good work accomplished. Had some queries that are base queries that are going to be used a lot. And was just banging on them, trying to get them to run a little faster, but was able to get everything I'm done with now to run with respectable speed. So, obviously, you can always use a bigger box and get things to run faster, but at least they are running with respectable speed. Have a couple of more to do. But I'm getting close on that. So that's good. Once I have all those data providers in place, then I have to build a little external model to throw them all together. And then I've got to take them and do a little bit of manipulation on them once I have them. I don't think it's going to be too bad. And then try to get them displayed on a screen, and that's normally is not that big of a deal, but I'm going to be supporting a legacy format because everybody is really used to seeing it that way. I mean, they just know exactly where to look to see what they need to see if it's okay and it's good, and that's what we need to do. And so because of that, we're actually going to support the old legacy format, because that will help them. And then as they get used to the new format of statements that I had developed earlier last year, you know, then we'll do a new one for them and cut them over to the new one. But it's all about supporting the user community, being useful for them, not just walking in and saying, thus you shall do it now. That never works out very well. Oh, I just shudder. I shudder whenever I hear IT people talking to user groups and the users in the user group are trying to say something and the IT guy is interrupting them and telling them the way they need to do it. I just shudder when I hear that. It's like, ugh. Thankfully, I don't hear that very often, but I have heard it recently. And it's just like, oh. Don't do that! Listen to them. Anyways, neither here nor there, wasn't my project. As my wife is fond of saying, not my monkeys, not my circus. So there you go. The writing is going well. It's going to be a challenge to hit 10,000 words this week. This time change business. I'm really hoping that by the end of this week, I'm going to be squared away, because I've been doing this thing where I just have the bulletproof coffee in the morning, and then, you know, I don't eat till 11:30, 12-ish, and then I stop eating 8 hours later. So that's been going fine. I haven't had any problem. And then the time change hit. And I was able to kind of muscle my way through on Sunday night, but Monday night, it got to be about 9:10, which 9:15, which would have been 10:15 normally for me. And my brain was just like, pfft. I mean, I still had 45 minutes to go, but it was not happening. It was either, okay, I'm going to go out and I'm, you know, going to get something to eat, or we're just going to pack it up. And I just packed it up. So instead of getting 1,000 words Monday night, I only got a little over 500. But then I was able to kind of get back cranking a little bit on Tuesday night. Last night, I cranked along pretty good, and I think I got myself caught up. Tonight, talking to a buddy, so that's going to take up some time, but I haven't talked to him in a long time. Always enjoy talking with him. So, it'll be interesting to see, but I'm only scheduled for 500 words tonight, so I'm pretty sure I can get that done, and if not, I'll get caught up tomorrow. So maybe 10,000 words. If I hit 10,000 words this week, I will be at 65,000, somewhere around 65,000, which is where I wanted to be when I started doing the beta edits. And the beta edits don't start until the week after next. So that gives me an extra week. If I can hit 10,000 next week, that puts me at about 75,000 words, which is really good. That should be well over halfway, which would be great. Which would be great. I still don't know for sure if I've got enough complications that I can make... that I can make this thing pull out for the rest of the book. I think I do. And just this week, I introduced a couple of new characters. And it feels like something's there. I've said this before. I'm kind of like a pig sniffing out truffles when I write. I just kind of get this scent of, it's over there somewhere. And I'm just gonna wander over there sniffing as I go, and hopefully I'm going to find it. And I usually do. At least I find it to my satisfaction. In the infinite possibilities that there are in writing, you have to eventually just pick a path and go with it. And so far, you know, it seems to be working out okay. It just works out okay. But so far, this book was a little... I'm not as happy this week with what I've put down as I have been in previous weeks, but I'm thinking that's part of the time change as well, because I know what I'm putting down, and it's exactly what's supposed to be putting down, but it's just as I'm a little foggy, you know, when I get to that point at night when I'm supposed to be cranking, it's just, I'm tired because it's past my bedtime, but I'm pushing to get in bed later, get up later, get myself converted over to the new time schedule, and, you know, slowly I am, so it's fine, I've heard back from some beta readers, and, you know, that all seems to be going fine. They have another week. I just heard from a beta reader today. She said, I'm going to be finished next week. Okay, that's fine. I will have it done by the 15th. Okay, that's fine. So we'll see. I've got to send my beta readers a little reminder. I send them gentle reminders, I call them. Just a gentle reminder. It's next week is the deadline. So, So I think it's all going to be fine. It's going to be fine. It's going to be really interesting to see over the long haul how many beta readers I actually end up with by the time I get to the 10th or 11th book. Because getting people to jump in at book 10 in a series, wow. I don't know if that's anywhere realistic or not. Because people, you know, when they hear, wait, this is book 10? Yeah, this is book 10. But it stands on its own, and there's a review section in the beginning can get you up to speed. You know, it'll get you up to speed. But it's book 10. Yeah, it's book 10. So we'll see. But it'll be fine. If I only end up with 2 beta readers, that's fine too. I'm just going to keep writing. This is a fascinating project. I get such a kick out of this project. There you go. Moving forward. Today, I came across a topic. I think this was on TechCrunch. TechCrunch. It was one of those tech websites. And I read the title of the article and I was like, oh, another bad idea in the pantheon of bad ideas. So the title of this article is Programming Hate into Artificial Intelligence Will Be Controversial, but Possibly Necessary. This is a bad idea, but, you know, I can understand what he's saying. This was written by Zoltan Istvan, who is a futurist, and he also happens to be the 2016 U.S. presidential candidate of the Transhumanist Party. There you go. So, you know, he's been involved with artificial intelligence for some time, probably. And he's been paying attention to it. And he makes the point that, yes, artificial intelligence is coming into the mainstream now. People actually talk about it at parties and offices and shops and over the dinner table. They talk about it. He said, my 5-year-old daughter brought it up the other night over taco lasagna. He said, when I asked her if anything interesting that happened at school, she replied that her teacher discussed smart robots. Okay, so, you know, when people first started, he pointed out in the article, which I thought was good, when people first started talking about artificial intelligence, what led the debate was epistemology. How do you know what you know? And the big question was, how can humans develop another intelligent consciousness if we can't even understand our own? Nobody is really sure where consciousness comes from at this point. Or even people have a hard time agreeing on even what a definition is. You know, and in our brain, a lot of people who are atheist humanists like to just reduce our consciousness to a function of the brain because the numbers seem sufficiently large to allow for surprises. There's 100 billion neurons with like 100 trillion connections. That's T, trillion with a T as in Tom. I mean, that's a lot. So people are comfortable saying, well, you know, with all those connections, it's an emergent property. It's an emergent property. Some people aren't convinced. Some people have some really interesting stuff that they point to. to say that no, consciousness is not reliant on the brain. Consciousness uses the brain as an interface to the physical world, but it can comprehend and ascertain things that should not be possible. And they point to stories of near-death experiences and documentation of people who have had a near-death experience and yet were aware of things they shouldn't have been able to be aware of because they were flatlined. So there's a lot of interesting stuff, but going with it at the moment that, in fact, consciousness just arrives as a function of our brains and of this 3 pounds of goo that we have between our ears. Just going with that for a moment, just for the sake of talking about this article. He does say in this article that most people argue that the key to consciousness is awareness. And of course, Descartes was the one that really kind of fathered that whole thing. I think, therefore I am. This awareness that we think means that we're conscious. Some people, that's not good enough. And so they think that, you know, in order to But thinking does not adequately define consciousness for some people. Justifying thinking is closer to the meaning that's adequate. And now I have the hiccups. It really should be, I believe I'm conscious, therefore I am. Now, what's interesting is that that doesn't quite ring right either, because you can have a robot insist all day that they're conscious, and that doesn't necessarily mean they are. He says in the article, we can teach it, we can't teach it to prove it's not a brain in a vat. Frankly, something that people can't do either. Because there's really no way for us to prove that all of our experiences are not simulated because our brain is in a vat somewhere and somebody is poking electrodes in it and making us think we're seeing what we're seeing and making us experience life as whoever is poking us in the vat is wanting us to be. Neither can we prove whether we are quote-unquote real or merely a simulation. So there's all this stuff, you know, about AI. The author himself kind of leans towards a theory called integrated information theory, developed by Giulio Tonani at University of Wisconsin, that assigns to any one brain or any complex system a number, denoted by the Greek symbol something, that theta, I don't know what that is, or omega, whatever. I think that's theta. That tells you how integrated a system is, how much more the system is than the union of its parts. So, you know, simply by having this quotient, you can say this integration therefore achieves a level of consciousness, even though it may be a type of consciousness that we would not recognize. And in that way, he would like to make the claim that the first autonomous superintelligence we create via machines may think and behave dramatically different than us. Yes, it might. And we need to keep that in mind. And the way it would behave dramatically different than that is something that I've been saying now for a while, and we'll get back to that in a minute. Dramatically different to us, so much so that it may not ever relate to us or vice versa. And, you know, this means you can get some pretty oddball things. He says in the article, in fact, every AI that we ever create in the future may leave us in very short order for distant parts of the digital universe. An ego-thumping concept made visual in the brilliant movie Her. Okay, I haven't seen that yet, but I gotta see that movie. He said, of course, an AI might just terminate itself too upon realizing it's alive and surrounded by curious humans peering at it. you know, or something else might happen, which I'll get to in a minute. Whatever happens, in the same way, there is an anthropological concept, cultural relativism. We must be ready for consciousness relativism, the idea that one consciousness may be totally different than another, despite the hope that math, logic, and coding will be obvious tools of communications. Okay. I absolutely am convinced that when we start bringing up the actual first versions of artificial intelligence, we are going to get to a place where, yes, it will be. I was getting my mail. It will be very different from that. And we'll get to that in a minute. He says, this makes more sense when you consider how small-minded humans and their consciousnesses might actually be. After all, nearly all of our perception comes from our five senses, which is how our brains make sense of the world. And every one of our senses is quite poor in terms of possible ability. The eye, for example, sees only about 1% of the universe's light spectrum. Okay, so yada, 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 yada. He says, this also reinforces my why I'm reluctant to believe that AI will be fundamentally like us. And I don't think it will be. Backing into my garage. One moment. Backing into my garage. Because he has a quote here. So I'm just going to go ahead and get this quote. And then we'll finish this up. And there we go. I think. Yes! Okay, need to learn more. Anyways, this also reinforces why I'm reluctant to believe that AI will fundamentally be like us. I surmise it may learn to replicate our behavior, perhaps even perfectly, but it will always be something different. Yep. Replication is no different than the behavior of a wind-up doll. Most humans hope for more of themselves than their consciousness. And of course, most AI engineers want much more for the machines they hope to give a conscious rise to. Now he goes on, he starts honing in on the whole point of the heart article. If I had to pinpoint one behavioral trait of consciousness that humans all have and should be instilled in AI, it would be empathy. Yeah, that would be nice. It's empathy that will form the type of AI consciousness that the world wants and needs, and one that people can also understand and accept. He says, on the other hand, if a created consciousness can empathize, then it must also be able to like or dislike and even love or hate something. This is a bad idea. For a consciousness to make judgments on value, both liking and disliking, love and hate functions must be part of the system. Which is a bad idea. And the reason it's a bad idea is, he says, he goes on and he says, that's much more controversial, especially in the drone age where machines control autonomous weaponry. Yes, that's the problem. But of course, he says anything less is just like wind-up doll consciousness. Said Kevin LeGrander, a professor at New York Institute of Technology, recently wrote, if a machine can truly be made to feel guilt in its varying degrees, then would we have problems of machine suffering and machine suicide? If we develop a truly strong artificial intelligence, we might, and then we would be faced with the moral problem of creating a suffering being. And worse than that, we'll get to that in just a second. So he says, such programs may lead to a world where robots, machines, and intelligence experience the same modern-day problems, angst, bigotry, depression, loneliness, and rage that are afflicting humanity. Aha! Now, here's the thing. I said this before, but this just triggered it again for me. We, I think, do have consciousness. I do not think we are without free will. I think that consciousness exists. And free will exists within a tenth of a second window, I've said this before, where there we really can choose our path, that it's not all just pre-programmed, that we could bring us back to exactly the same spot with exactly the same inputs, with exactly the same circumstances around us, and it's possible that we might choose differently. It is possible. Unlikely, I think, in a lot of cases, but possible. Because I think a great many of us are balanced, precariously balanced on this amazing tipping point of controlling our behavior enough that we can be classified sane. And I think it is, we've got neighborhood animals approaching, so I'm going to put down the garage door to where they're not inside the garage, and I'm having to shoo them out. I think we do not have a deep enough appreciation for how we remain on that tipping point. Granted, there are people who go crazy in our world. Yes, we have mental facilities to help people. Yes, we have people in therapy. Yes, 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 yes. But a surprising number of human beings in a surprising number of circumstances are resilient. I think part of that is due to the fact that God is speaking to us all, that He is wooing us all, that His Spirit is here, and that it's drawing us. There's an interesting passage in prophecy that talks about when the Holy Spirit is taken away, that everything starts coming apart. And so I suspect that this ability that we have to actually choose to remain sane is in some part weighted by the interactions that we have with God down at the very core of our being. If that's true, and frankly, even if it's not true, artificial intelligence will not have that. And I think what we're going to find is it's a whole lot harder to create a stable intelligence than we think it is. I mean, we in the 50s were saying, well, artificial intelligence, what's the big deal? We've got programs. They can play chess. We're going to have artificial intelligence. 10 years. Yeah, well, not 10 years. It wasn't 20 years. You're 50 years down the road now, and we still don't have it. And I think what we're going to find that even when we get all the horsepower we need, there's a lot of cool stuff going on right now in the whole deep learning stuff. And it's still not artificial intelligence. It's just deep learning. But I think even when we get to that artificial intelligence thing, one of the big rude awakenings that we're going to come to really fast is artificial intelligence that goes crazy, artificial intelligence that commits suicide, artificial intelligence that tries to get out and wreak havoc. And the people who are working on the artificial intelligence system, I would hope, but I already know it won't be, I would hope that they would not be working on interconnected systems and up in the cloud and all that kind of thing, because this could go bad very, very quickly. And I am not alone in saying this. You know, and you get the Stephen Hawkings of the world and the Elon Musks of the world, and they're all saying, we need to think about this. But of course we won't. We just won't, because we're ego-driven and we want to be the ones that get there first. And there won't be precautions, and there won't be this, and there won't be that. And we're going to be in for a ride. It's just one of those things that's going to happen over the next 20 years. But, you know, at the end of the day, there's nothing to fear. It'll all be fine. But I think all these artificial intelligence engineers, they are in for a rude awakening when they find out how hard it is to create a stable artificial intelligence. And when they finally realize that they may never have the chance, because it's going to be really fascinating to see what happens when we start going down this road. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.